First, we're answering two listener questions that came in through WPR's Wisconsin Project about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century. An anonymous listener from Juneau County asked, what in our society has changed since 1849? What did people in Wisconsin in those times feel that human life at all stages should be protected by law? And Jill from Madison asked, is there any record on how that law was enforced prior to Roe v. Wade in 1972? The way people felt about abortion in the 19th century was complicated, sometimes divided, just like today. There was no one way people thought about it, just like today. But competing narratives about that history can make it even more difficult to understand. For example, in his draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito writes that abortion bans passed in the mid-1800s, like Wisconsin's, were, quote, spurred by a sincere belief that abortion kills a human being, end quote. Some historians dispute that idea and say that the laws were pushed by the medical profession's desire to take control from midwives, among other reasons. We're talking about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of abortion and abortion laws? What have you heard about the way people used to think about the issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, a leading authority on the history of the abortion debate in the U.S. Her latest book is Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement, and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Kimberly Riley is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies and history, chair of the history program, and co-chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program at UW-Green Bay. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with that first listener question, Kim. Can you talk about what people in Wisconsin, the variety of ways people in Wisconsin might have thought about abortion in the mid-1800s when this law came into effect?
Sure. Well, I mean, what we know about the law that was passed in 1849 is that it actually made the killing of a quick child an act of manslaughter. And I think it's important for folks to understand what that phrase quick child meant. What that meant was a child that had undergone quickening. And quickening was the feeling of fetal movement that a pregnant woman would feel, which takes place between usually the fourth and sixth month of pregnancy. And so stretching back from the 13th century all the way up through the mid-19th century, 13th century in Europe, mid-19th in the United States, the quickening doctrine prevailed in law. And what that meant was that it was acceptable to end a pregnancy before quickening was felt. So I would say that in Wisconsin, there were many people who would have imagined that restoration of your menstruation or a kind of they use the language of unblocking in the mid-19th century, which effectively was abortion, would have seen that as perfectly acceptable before, maybe even the 6 month of pregnancy.
And Mary, that law gets revised 9 years later, 1858, taking out the word quick. Was this a common debate, a common system of changes around the country to go from that banning abortion after the quickening, as Kim was just saying, and narrowing that down?
It was. There was a movement led by the American Medical Association that took issue with this quickening distinction across the country and, seemed to have unsurprisingly complicated motives for a social movement of this kind. But the American Medical Association was pushing that kind of proposal, not just in Wisconsin, but in states across the country, was even pushing it, with the president of the United States in Congress. So this was definitely a national transformation, not just a local one.
Now, Kim, Wisconsin becomes a state in 1848, the first abortion law you're talking about passed in 1849. Was this, a specific thing saying, hey, we have to tackle this abortion issue, or is this just something that Wisconsin did as it was becoming a state?
Well, I mean, we don't know precisely. I mean, we know that they're trying to codify the common law, and that's something that's happening also in some states during the mid-19th century. There's an effort made by some legal reformers to kind of rationalize and make, common law's judicial decisions. And so if you put something into statute, you potentially make it more predictable, you create more sort of rational ways of entry in terms of procedures that lawyers would have to undergo to bring cases. So I think this is, you know, likely a matter of the state taking the common law. They're not really changing the common law. They're just sort of putting it into statute, you know, as the state is becoming a state.
And Mary, law and common law is one thing. Actual practice, and you were starting to touch on this, was another. What was the landscape like when it came to terminating early pregnancies in the mid-1800s?
Well, we know that one of the reasons that there was this national movement to criminalize abortion was because there was a perception that abortion was increasingly common, especially in urban communities, although certainly not exclusively in those communities. And we know, too, that once states began criminalizing abortion earlier in pregnancy, as Wisconsin did, prosecutions remained pretty unusual, with the exception of cases where, you know, a pregnant woman died during the procedure too. So even as Wisconsin was sort of joining other states in passing further reaching abortion bans, there was a pretty big, I think, disjuncture between the letter of the law and how people were living their lives.
We are answering Wisconsin questions about attitudes toward abortion and laws and enforcement of laws on abortion. Not now, not in this last century, but in the mid-1800s, when these laws first came into effect. They're now back into effect, effectively in the state. You could join in with your questions about that history at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With us are Mary Ziegler, University of California, Davis Law Professor, and Kim Riley, Associate Professor at UW Green Bay. Kim, there was a key figure here in Wisconsin connected to the national scene, William Henry Brisbane, a doctor on the American Medical Association committee that reported on criminal abortion. Can you talk about his influence here in the state at the time?
Sure. I mean, I would say we don't have a complete historical record on Dr. Brisbane, but from the information we do have, we know he was a Baptist minister that was born in South Carolina. And he moved to Wisconsin in the 1850s, and he became chief clerk of the state Senate in 1857. And as you say, he was appointed by the American Medical Association to report on its efforts to criminalize and suppress abortion. And he, in some letters that he wrote to colleagues, he expressed fears about particularly middle class and upper class women seeking abortions and even using birth control. And he wrote to a colleague that he wanted to get a law passed that criminalized both birth control and abortion in Wisconsin. And so, of course, you know, the law did not include birth control, but you know, that so it's likely that he had a kind of influence over this 1858 law. And he wrote in another letter to a colleague that he didn't actually expect the law to be enforced, but he hoped that it would have a moral influence over people. So I think even he was pragmatic about, you know, as Professor Ziegler saying, the realities of enforcement of these anti-abortion, criminalization of abortion laws.
And Mary, Kim takes us to our second listener question there about enforcement of these abortion laws. What did that look like after states like Wisconsin passed abortion laws, whether it was after quickening or in 1858 across the board?
There was a lot of under enforcement. So again, we don't have complete data, but by some estimates from the 19th century, abortion rates were actually climbing after the passage of these criminal laws. And prosecutions, notwithstanding that fact, seem to be very rare unless a pregnant patient died. And so you had this kind of odd sort of dual mindset that appeared to exist, because you had lots of states like Wisconsin, you know, passing abortion laws, maybe seemingly eliminating the quickening distinction, and simultaneously people's actual experience with abortion, their willingness to have abortions, perform abortions, didn't seem fundamentally different. And in fact, prosecutors were very unlikely to enforce the laws. So I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to kind of generalize about whether this was an era when attitudes about abortion were different in some ways from ours, because there was no single attitude I think we can identify.
We're talking about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century, when Wisconsin and many other states passed, in some cases, their first laws banning abortion in some or all instances. Our guests are Mary Ziegler, professor at the University of California, Davis School of Law, and Kim Riley, associate professor of democracy and justice studies, history, and women's studies at UW Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about this history, that's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the history of abortion and attitudes toward abortion when laws were passed in the mid-1800s. Our guests are Kim Riley, Associate Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies, History and Women's Studies at UW-Green Bay, and Mary Ziegler, Professor at the University of California Davis School of Law. These come from questions through our Why Sconson project about attitudes toward abortion in the 1800s and enforcement of those laws. And Mary, our questioners are really on the right track here, I think, because these historical issues, and you've written about this, they were cited in the original Roe v. Wade decision, and they were cited in the Dobbs decision this year. Can you talk about how important different views of this history have been in setting laws at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think for the Roe Court, the history was relevant to show that there was no kind of longstanding tradition of opposition to abortion. The Roe Court ultimately wasn't focusing entirely on history and tradition and reaching an outcome. It was instead saying, you know, primarily that the right to privacy, right, a right that encompassed other decisions that were life-changing, like the ability to use contraception or to marry or to decide with whom you lived or to raise children or to procreate, was a similar right. But Justice Blackmun, the author of Roe, spent a lot of time saying that there was no kind of unbroken tradition of opposition to abortion. And he looked at some of this 19th century history and said, well, you know, at the time before that, abortion wasn't widely criminalized. Even after that, attitudes seemed to have been more complicated. And he also emphasized that, in his view, attitudes had changed, right? So there had been more support for abortion in recent years, which he considered to be constitutionally significant. The Supreme Court this summer in the Dobbs case took a different approach to history. I think one saying the only thing that matters historically or really constitutionally either is what happened in the 19th century. It doesn't matter if people's attitudes have changed since then or if, you know, the world has changed such that, you know, women can vote now and couldn't vote then, among other things. What matters is what happened at the time the relevant part of the Constitution was written. And Alito took a view, I think that's it's fair to say it's a minority view in the academy, but there are some scholars who think this, that abortion had always been criminally, either criminal or at least widely viewed as immoral throughout pregnancy and certainly criminalized after quickening. And that if that was true, there could be no abortion right, essentially. People who would have criminalized abortion would not have thought that abortion was a constitutional right. So that history has been pretty high stakes from the beginning. And I think especially now when we have a Supreme Court that says that whether we have rights or not on a particular subject depends entirely on what the court believes the framers of the Constitution believed at a specific moment in the past.
We got a call from Carol in Appleton who couldn't stay on the line. Carol wants to know about the 1985 Wisconsin abortion law, wondering why it hasn't superseded the 1849 law. So this was a law passed under Roe v. Wade, changing the law. Someone in Wisconsin is the subject of active lawsuits in Wisconsin now. Kim, why hasn't that 1985 law effectively superseded what was in place in 1858?
You know, honestly, I'm sure Mary could do a better job than I could at answering that question. But my understanding is that it's, as you say, currently kind of winding its way through the courts and potentially serving as a challenge to the 1849/1858 law.
Mary, do you have you been following Wisconsin that closely?
I mean, I think in a way. I mean, I think there's a question about the ban. Obviously, is the older ban is much older. The challenges, I think, tend to be whether these laws can automatically, and I'm trying to simplify this, come back into effect once Roe is gone. I think the argument that folks make that isn't possible or that it would not be superseded by the 1985 law is essentially that, you know, holding a law like the earlier Wisconsin ban unconstitutional doesn't erase it from the statute books. It just sort of leaves it there like a zombie waiting around. And then as soon as Roe v. Wade is gone, in theory, that would resurrect the law. And it would then add to the prohibitions in the 1985 law, which my understanding is kick in only after fetal viability. So I think that's the argument. Obviously, this is something that's caught up in ongoing litigation, so I don't think we have a clear answer. But I think the idea is that the 1985 law banned abortion as far as legislators at the time felt they were able to, which was at viability. And that it wasn't intended to supersede more sweeping bans that had been introduced in the 19th century, but were kind of frozen in place as long as Roe v. Wade was the law.
We are answering why Wisconsin questions about abortion in Wisconsin in the 1800s when our first laws came into effect soon after we became a state. Mary Ziegler with us and Kimberly Riley, both professors who have studied these issues. Kim, you've written, I think, about how women in the 19th century understood abortion, might have thought about that. Can you give us some insight into what their mindsets might have been?
Sure. I think it's important for people today to think back and realize that there were no pregnancy tests in the 19th century. So if you no longer had your period, and particularly if we're talking about the mid-19th century, that might be because of any number of causes, right? You might have some sort of illness. You might have some sort of irregularity. And at a certain point, you might desire to restore your regular menstrual cycle. And that's the way that women often talked about it and discussed it. And that's the way that even in the late 19th century, after these bans passed, you see a lot of abortifacient medicines, basically these sort of non-regulated herbal compounds that would be marketed to women. They are described in terms of being able to regulate women's cycles or expel tumors from their uterus. And they use very coded language to basically advertise the fact that they can bring on menses when it's stopped. But it's very clear from the language that they use that it's, you know, something that women understood to be either restoring their menses or potentially, you know, kind of precipitating a spontaneous miscarriage and abortion. So I think things were less clear cut, right, in the 19th century when we think about, you know, there's no little stick with a kind of, you know, plus sign on it that you mm-hmm. can kind of hold up and say, yes, I'm pregnant. So I think that we have to think about those complications when we think about attitudes.
And staying with attitudes, Mary, can you talk a little bit about the, I guess, cultural mindset about behind the anti-abortion effort, the effort to pass laws in states around the country?
Well, I mean, unsurprisingly, it was complicated, right? So I think one of the listeners who wrote in suggested that the people who were trying to criminalize abortion, the doctors, had an investment in the idea that life began at conception. And we have some evidence, certainly they've made that argument. That was a significant, at least, claim that they made and justification for their attitudes. They also made other arguments that I think would be less familiar to us today. They seemed concerned about the relative birth rates of Catholics and Protestants. So they were arguing that across the country, as Catholic immigration from states like Ireland increased, that that Catholic women were having more children than Protestant women, and that this was bad for the future of the country from a kind of eugenic standpoint. They made arguments about gender, essentially the idea being that women who were having abortions were kind of betraying their obligations to their husbands to have children and to be wives. And they even suggested that this was a sort of professional gatekeeping responsibility, because this was a time when the medical profession as a whole was much more kind of porous and less regulated than we're used to today. And I think this idea that only certain kinds of doctors understood when life began and only certain kinds of doctors had the moral fiber to oppose abortion was one point of differentiation in this very competitive market between doctors, midwives, and, you know, other kinds of homeopaths, other practitioners. So I think there were lots of motives that these activists seemed to have. So if you're trying to kind of pinpoint, you know, was it really all about fetal life, or was it really all about eugenics, or was it really all about gender roles? The answer seems to be yes to all of them. And I think sometimes it's hard to disentangle whether those things even, you know, were related internally.
And Kim, in our last minute or so, it can be tough to untangle our look at this history from the arguments we're having now in 2022. Is it possible, do you think, as we dig back into the history, to get a clear picture, given the biases we may all bring into it?
I mean, I think it is possible if we allow that the picture is probably more complicated than any of us, you know, would sort of imagine it to be when we come in with our present day biases. It's not a conversation of life versus choice in the 19th century. And I think if we can get beyond that and kind of open up to other possibilities, we might get a more accurate picture.
And briefly, Mary, is it important to do that?
I think so. I mean, I think it's important to understand our history. And it's also important to remember that history isn't sort of like an input-output machine. And often when we look at history, we're going to see messiness and nuance. So while I think it's important to understand kind of how we got where we are and where we are, I think it's also important to approach history from the standpoint of something that is going to be more complicated than kind of black and white debates we may want to have about a subject like abortion.
We'll leave it there. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, a leading authority on the history of the abortion debate in the U.S. And Kimberly Riley is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies and history, chair of the history program, and co-chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program at UW Green Bay. They join us to answer listener questions submitted through WPR's Why Wisconsin project about views on abortion in the 19th century when Wisconsin became a state and when original laws on the topic came into effect. If you have a Wisconsin-related question you'd like us to tackle, big or small, let us know. You can share your question online at WPR.org/WHY Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y Wisconsin.